Today we're moving on round the mandala into the west. And so we're talking about Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. And influenced by the weather, this talk is called Raining Flowers, Raining Wisdom. So as we come round into the west, we find that the whole mandala, the whole of our mind, permeated by a wonderful red colour, the redness of the setting sun. Sunset's that marvellous time of day where you can look directly at that great burning ball of fire that is the sun, and it doesn't hurt your eyes. You can just dwell on it, you can just take it in, you can just bathe in that redness. And a lot of the symbolism of Amitabha is connected with this. There's a lot that we could say about Amitabha. I was coming downstairs just thinking we could spend 2 weeks just on Amitabha, just unpacking all the associations and connections. But I've got two talks, so we'll see what we can do. So let's start by seeing Amitabha in our mind's eye, helped by Amrita's picture there. So again, he will appear out of clear blue sky. Clear blue sky of the completely open, liberated mind, clinging to nothing at all. And then out of that sky appears a lotus throne, which has upon it a white moon mat. And seated on that white moon mat is a Buddha, a completely awakened being, Amitabha, infinite light. And his body is made of this wonderful red light, sort of soft but very strong at the same time. And once again, he's dressed in silks and jewels. He has dark hair. His body gives off light in all directions. And usually he's portrayed as sitting with his hands in his lap in what's called the Dhyana Mudra, the meditation mudra. So the fingers rest on one another, and the thumbs just touch, so that the hands are embracing a certain kind of space within them. So it's an image of balance, of harmony, and as we might see later, of wisdom as well. But there's also another appearance in Amitabha, a form that appeared to Bhante Sangharakshita early in his days in India when he was a wanderer. He had a very strong vision of Amitabha when he was staying, meditating in a cave, where Amitabha is not in the Dhyana Mudra. With his right hand, he's holding up a red lotus. And you can see behind the lotus in the distance, there's sea and the setting sun. So this is the figure that we're going to live with today especially, but which will be part of our mandala for the rest of the retreat. And there are many associations with Amitabha. We saw with the other Buddhas that on their side of the mandala, within their realm, are all kinds of both spiritual and natural aspects of life. So Amitabha is associated with red, with sunset, with the west, with the lotus, with the peacock, with fire. And then it's also associated with transforming, drawing the energy from craving, and with discriminating wisdom, with wisdom that sees the uniqueness of every experience. He's also associated with Sukhavati, the land of bliss. Each of these Buddhas has a sort of pure realm that they create. When you enter the state of mind of that Buddha, then the entire experience of that Buddha, the entire experience of the world and the environment, is transformed. So Sukhavati is the pure realm of Amitabha. And he's also has a family of other figures associated with him in his lotus family, which include Tara, or some forms of Tara, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, and Padmasambhava. And there are all sorts of other associations. He's associated with, particularly with communication and with the throat. You can find a complete list in that book I was recommending the other day, whatever it was. So we've been seeing how the whole mandala emanates from Shakyamuni, emanates from the experience of the historical Buddha. So let's look at where Amitabha appears out of Shakyamuni's experience. Well, firstly, Amitabha is a meditating Buddha. He's in the mudra of meditation, and meditation is clearly central to Shakyamuni's life and his attainment of enlightenment. He gains enlightenment in deep meditation under the Bodhi tree. And he continued meditating, as far as we know, all through his life. Just even post-enlightenment, he was continuing to enter meditation and to unfold that experience, that awakened experience, more and more and more. But along with that, it seems to me that Amitabha particularly appears from an incident around the time of the Enlightenment, which is another part of Mara's attempts to head the Buddha off at the pass, to prevent him from gaining enlightenment, to prevent him from escaping Mara's realm, which is the realm of suffering and stagnation. To prevent the Buddha from completely coming to life with awakening. And in this incident, Mara isn't trying anything very subtle. He's not asking the Buddha questions to produce little bits of self-doubt. In this incident, Mara produces an army to just try and drive the Buddha away from the Vajra seat. And some of the early texts really have fun sort of describing the army that Mara raises and all the weapons that they find to hurl at the Buddha. And so they're throwing sort of tree trunks and rocks and all kinds of things at him. And what does the Buddha do? He just sits there. He doesn't do anything. except that he sits there in deep meditation. And as all these weapons come hurtling through the air towards him, they just transform. They all transform into flowers, and they just drop. It's a gentle rain of flowers. Just, you can imagine them dropping all around the Buddha, sort of falling onto his shoulders. He's probably got flowers in his hair as he's sitting there. Just, the flowers are, it's a rain of flowers. This rain of weapons has become a rain of flowers. And it's a really strong image for me. I think it's one of the sort of most moving, evocative images in early Buddhism. And it's an image that is well worth reflecting on, because as we enter meditation, we at times find Mara is producing, maybe not an entire army, maybe we're not practicing seriously enough for him to sort of be bothered to spend the time and energy on us to send a whole army against us. But still, you get the odd rock and the odd tree trunk, flying in your direction here and there. And you find, to put it in another way, you find uncomfortable experiences, you find uncomfortable emotions, you find the pull of craving, you find gales of aversion all appearing. As you do the sort of spiritual archaeology of meditation, you sort of uncover all kinds of things. So how do you approach all that? What do you do? And for me, that image of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, seated in meditation, allowing that rain of weapons to turn to flowers, is quite a key image for what I do and how I see some of the process of transformation, some of the work that I do in meditation. So I think you can see the image on a number of levels. So first off, perhaps the simplest level for me is that what the Buddha is doing, if we take, let's take it that Mara and his army are internal. They are aspects of the Buddha's own mind. That what the Buddha is doing, first off, is creating a gap of awareness between the stimulus, the painful feeling that he's experiencing in meditation, and how he responds or how he reacts to that. In any situation in life, never mind not just in meditation, if there's no gap of awareness, then we have no choice. Whenever there's no awareness, we simply do whatever we're habitually kind of programmed to do. So if there's no awareness and somebody throws a rock at us, then we may just find ourselves throwing it back. But the Buddha doesn't kind of get up and start hurling the tree trunks back at Mara's army and fighting them off. He's sitting there completely aware of the situation and aware of his responses, which gives him freedom. No awareness, no choice. No awareness, no freedom. You're just identified with the situation. You don't really know what you're doing. You just do whatever you do. So, no awareness, no spiritual life. No awareness, no Dharma, really, to some extent. Unless you just happen to be, your habitual responses have already been trained by the Dharma or already happen to be quite good. But fundamental to all our practice is making that gap between feeling and craving in the 12 Nidanas, between what life is giving us and how we respond. And that's kind of our first work, all the time as Buddhists, but particularly on a retreat like this, is just to keep dwelling as much as we can in that gap of awareness, just seeing what's happening, making that space. Because it's in that space that things can be transformed. It's like the aura around the Buddha, first off, is an aura of awareness. So if we are creating that space, then it means that we're not just driven by painful experience, we're not just pulled by pleasant experience, we're not just driven by what people will think of us in different ways, or what we call the worldly winds in Buddhism. Pleasure and pain, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and infamy. If those are at the centre of our mandala, then we're in trouble. We have always to have enough awareness to be noticing when we're being driven by those things, and to be able to refer to something deeper. So if in a situation we feel we're just being driven by praise and blame, what people will think of us, then we've lost our choice, we've lost our freedom. So we have to refer to something closer to the centre of our mandala, actually to find that and operate out of that. Yeah, so we may have to dig deep in certain situations where we can see that we're in a situation of praise and blame. Can we find enough depth in ourselves to actually do what we really believe in, rather than just be pushed by what the others will think, what the group will think? All those kinds of issues, all those come into creating that gap of awareness between feeling and that automatic response. We have to keep breaking that. We also need that gap of awareness, because if there's no gap of awareness, then we're just identified with what's happening. We're just identified. We can't explore, we can't look to see whether we could do things differently. If we're identified with our views, with what we think, then we just live out of that way of thinking. We just live our lives through that filter of those views. And in the course of our lives, we pick up from around us, from our family, from schooling, from the media, from one another, all kinds of views. And some of them are really helpful, and some of them are completely disastrous for our lives. But unless we can actually make a gap of awareness and see what it is that we're telling ourselves about life, what it is we're telling ourselves about what's going on in the situation, then we have no freedom to change it. We just go along. So that gap of awareness breaks that sense of identification with things. And that gives us the freedom to look and see, is this a good way to act? Is this a helpful way to think? Is this a helpful way to respond emotionally? All those things we can then begin to transform. We can forge ourselves anew with views that are really helpful, with emotions that are beneficial for us and for other people, and so on. So that's the first level, just dwelling in the gap of awareness, creating that gap of awareness. And then secondly, I think we can see the weapons turning into flowers, because the aura around the Buddha is an aura of love and compassion. this is the traditional antidote to the kind of aggression and violence that's being launched at him. Around the Buddha is this great aura of, maybe it is red light, of just love, compassion, of metta. And that metta forms a kind of, to change the image, an alchemical crucible in which everything can transform. When we were looking at Ratnasambhava yesterday and positive emotion, as I was introducing the metta bhavana, I was approaching it first off with the sense that whatever our experience of ourselves in meditation, our first response should always be to kind of turn towards it. To turn towards it with as much kindness as we can muster. Even if it's something we don't like the look of, even if it's something which we feel really needs transforming, still, it's not that we just accept it and go, oh, there, you're there, you know, you great tendency to destructiveness, well, you know, I just love you as you are. It's not quite like that. That's not the end of the process, but it is the beginning of the process. It's a bit like if you're in communication with somebody else, and they're a good friend, say, and they're doing something that you feel really doesn't help them. First off, you need to just be there and hear them with as much kindness and understanding as you can muster. And if they really feel like you're being right there with them and you care about them and you're interested and you want to understand, then you have the real possibility that the two of you together can help really move things on. If you sit down with that person and they feel that basically you just want them to stop being how they are because you don't like it, that isn't going to be very successful, you will find. Well, I have found in my experience over the last 60 years. So, it's the same with ourselves. If we want to transform the deeper sort of tendencies in ourselves, if we want to particularly transform some of the deeper powerful forces in ourselves, some of them quite difficult, quite intransigent, then we have to just turn towards them with as much receptivity, as much understanding, as much care as we can. I mean, if we're practicing metta, well, we're aiming to do that with all our experience all the time. But particularly in this sort of area, I'm partly talking about this because on retreat, in that kind of alchemical crucible of a retreat, you do find at times that, yes, sometimes you may be in very inspired states, but at other times it's as if deeper unresolved issues think, wow, this might actually be conditions where we could sort of come up and show ourselves and be healed. And they start to appear over the horizon of consciousness, and some of the time we look at them and go, I'm not like that, am I? Which is a whole ego reaction to start with. And what do? Well, some of the time we just go, oh, no, I'm a Buddhist, I don't experience that kind of thing. That's one good way of making sure that they don't try and get healed again for a while. You can just be on the run from them. You just kind of So you just bounce off them. You just get a little glimpse of something in yourself and think, and you just don't want to go there, thank you very much. And you just ignore it. You just treat it like it's not there. But then, of course, it doesn't go away because it wants to be healed, please. Could you just give it some attention? You know, could I just have some attention so that, you know, could I just have some love and some understanding? And then I'd be fine. In fact, I'd be really helpful and I'd be part of mandala. And it would be fantastic. So this kind of ghost keeps sort of haunting you because you're just not turning towards your experience. You know, there's aspects of your experience that somehow, you know, you don't want to accept because it doesn't fit your view of yourself. And because of that, they get left out in the cold. And then they cause... How are they to make you aware that they're there? Well, the only way they can do it is by sabotaging you. So then you keep finding there's a sort of undertow in your practice. There you are, you know, striving onwards, wonderful, heroic Buddhist. But then somehow it never quite works, and there's this sense, you know, you get ill or something happens to you. You never quite manage to arrive at that supreme ideal that you've, you know, set your heroic soul to achieve, because you're trying to do it by leaving parts of yourself out. So it's just really important that as we're meditating together, as we're practicing together, we can really kind of look after one another's sort of difficult areas. We can really encourage one another to take the risk, which it is, of experiencing ourselves fully in all our sort of heights and depths. And it's one of the things about human beings is that we have access to all six realms, actually. We can go into the heights of dhyana, we can go into real sort of hellish states as well. And we all have all those potentials in us. So rather than being kind of surprised, we need to just have a very kind of open attitude. Okay, it doesn't really matter what comes up. It will all be transformed. There's nothing that can't be transformed if we just set up the right conditions. If we just treat ourselves kindly. If we just bring awareness to things. If we rely on our spiritual friends. And a retreat like this is a fantastic opportunity for that deep work, that deep healing work, that really spiritual work of turning towards the difficult and the unacceptable and the untransformed to happen. And that really sort of softens a lot of our hard edges. It's interesting that Amitabha is associated with the lotus family and with flowers. It's as if, you know, just doing that work, all those kind of rough, hard edges, which are usually the places where we don't sit easy with ourselves, and so we also then bump into them in other people as well. All those soften, and they all become, you know, sort of easier, more pliable, more malleable. They all become eventually an adornment of ourselves. So this is another way to look at this incident, is that the aura around the Buddha that transforms all those weapons is an aura of loving kindness, of care, of compassion. Often we're very good at having compassion for other people who suffer and not very good at having compassion for our own suffering. We can do self-pity quite well, but that's not the same thing. So then there's a third level even, which is that the aura around the Buddha is a level of insight, of seeing how things really are, of clear knowing. These three are progressive, really. It's like, to start with, you have to create awareness. There has to be a gap of awareness so you know what's there, so you can look at it. You're not just identified with it, you're not just carried along being it in an unconscious way. So once there's that gap of awareness, then your experience arises, and it all needs kind of warming and tempering and, yeah, healing and caring for, whatever it is. And that then creates the conditions where we can do the liberating work of seeing the nature of what's arising, of understanding it as it really is. So, for the Buddha, there's also a dawning in his enlightenment experience, a seeing of the nature of things. So, whatever the experience is that he's having, he's seeing that it's change, that it's flow, that it's impermanent, to use that good Buddhist word. And so he also sees that if you don't cling on to the experience, it passes. It comes, it goes. It comes, it goes. It arises in dependence on conditions, and when those conditions change, it changes. It transforms into some other kind of experience. And so you can imagine the Buddha there in deep meditation, and there are experiences arising, but he's seeing, he's watching them come, watching them go, watching how the conditions are created to have this unique experience right now, and then for it to transform into something else as the conditions change. You can see him seeing deeply into things, seeing that nothing has got any fixed essence at all. There is just flow. Yes, there are kind of eddies in the flow which look like they're fixed, but they're just habitual patterns. There's nothing that you can finally get hold of. All experience is ungraspable. Like a bubble. Like a bubble on a stream. Like a bubble on a stream seen in a vision. Like a bubble on a stream seen in a vision in a dream. So really, nothing graspable. There's life, but just this complete flow. And the only way in which things become fixed things is when you create a whole idea about them so that you can control them. Then you can have fixed things. And the Buddha does this for all his experience, and he also does it for his sense of me. Me, the meditator, me on the verge of enlightenment. He looks at that too. He looks at the I that feels threatened by the incoming attack of Mara's army. The me that feels anxious about that. The me that wants to fight back. The me that wants to run away. He looks at who is it that wants to run away and fight back. Because that's the unquestioned assumption, that sense of me sort of in the centre of all my experience or standing behind all my experience that doesn't change and that's always been me and always will be me, except that we're a bit anxious in case that we might not be me, so we're constantly making sure that we will carry on being me. That's almost like the unquestioned assumption underlying how we experience the world. And that's the unquestioned assumption that holds the whole of samsara, of our suffering together. Yeah. And it's to defend this unquestioned sense of fixed, unchanging, inherently existing me that we create that whole, well, what Ratnaprabha described as the ego castle yesterday, right in the centre. That ego castle is all to protect this sense of fixed, unchanging me. That ego castle with its great black towers and its searchlights and so forth. And it's the centre of our world. And all our maps of life and how to live it, on those, all roads lead to the ego castle. But strangely enough, when we look directly into our experience, in meditation, we don't find any fixed me at all. It seems really odd. It seems so obvious at times, you know. If somebody's kind of rude to us or criticises us, we think, well, they can't say that to me. And that me that they can't say that to feels like the one thing you know exists in that moment. But when we look into it, well, what is it? There's a kind of clenching in the body. There's an idea of me. There's a really strong feeling. There's lots of energy. But all those things, they're all changing, aren't they? The body changes all the time. It clenches and unclenches. One thought leads to another thought. One feeling leads to another. There's awareness there, but even that seems to be changing. So is there a fixed me standing behind all our experience or not? When we look, and we all need to look and know for ourselves, what the Buddha found was that he couldn't find one. He couldn't find that fixed sense of me at all. Yeah. What we find is just more of the flow of life. So when we explore deeply into our experience and we look at the me that's having the experience, then we find there's just more experience. It's not a separate me sort of behind it somewhere. And that, in that sense, the ego castle is empty. The ego castle, which is really a prison. And when we get to that point, when we see that clearly enough, then we become reunited with life. That sense that we have of separate me, kind of cut off from the rest of life, that disappears. We become reunited. We are once more fully the flow of life, rather than having a sense of being kind of a watcher sitting on the bank watching it go by. We're reunited with life, we're reunited with all beings. We stand shoulder to shoulder with all beings. And so great compassion then arises. And that fire of insight, that fire of seeing how things really are, burns the ego castle to the ground. And from the ashes, the rubble, the ashes of that ego castle, phoenix-like, appears the Mandala Palace. And the Mandala Palace is beautiful and spacious, and it's also open on all sides. Whereas before you just had that portcullis and then the drawbridge and then the moat. Now, on each side of the Mandala, you have a beautiful sort of dual doorway through which life can enter and through which you can go out into life. So, Shakyamuni wasn't threatened by Mara's army because finally he saw that there was no one to be threatened. So there are those three levels. There's dwelling in the gap of awareness. That creates an aura in which we have the freedom to move and to work. There's love and compassion, which melts, softens, heals, transforms. And then there's the level of insight, which does the final liberating work of actually seeing through all our assumptions about life to see how life really is. And that's what really sets us free, particularly when we see the ungraspable nature of things and we see that we aren't a completely separate me standing somewhere aside from life. So, all this is contained in the image of Amitabha. And he's in Dhyana Mudra, and has in his hands a lotus flower. It's as if, having overcome Mara's armies through his deep meditation, having watched all those weapons turn to flowers, at a certain point he's just opened his eyes for a moment and just picked one of the flowers, just picked up a lotus, and he's just kind of holding it as a souvenir, as a treasure from the battle with Mara. He's just meditating with that flower, with that lotus. So I find it a very positive, beautiful image. And that flower, that souvenir from the overcoming of the hordes of Mara through awareness and love and insight, it gives me a really positive message, particularly when I'm up against difficult areas of myself, when I've fallen into one of the sort of Visantara traps on the path, when I'm wrestling with things that I really don't like the look of in myself, I find it really helpful just to remind myself, that lotus reminds me that I don't need to be scared of my own mind. It's ridiculous in a way to be scared of my own mind. And that there's no need to be on the run from my own feelings. With the right conditions, with spiritual friends and guides, with the Dharma, with the inspiration of the Buddha, and with a correct approach to meditation and spiritual practice, which includes creating that gap of awareness, that gap of freedom, which includes loving kindness and compassion, and just doing my best to turn towards my experience, whatever it is, because it's my experience. As I said yesterday, if we're having a difficult experience, that is the only experience we are having right now. So we might as well care for it. That sense of, well, I don't want this experience, I want some other experience, that's just arguing with the facts. Whenever you argue with the facts in life, you always lose. All that's happening now is this experience. So, yeah, let's turn towards it. Because if we turn towards it, it will transform. If we turn towards it, it will become a support. If we turn towards it, it can be healed. Yeah. So with all those conditions, everything can be transformed. So in Subhuti's and Kamala Shila's mapping of Sri Ratna's system of practice onto the mandala, Amitabha and the Western Direction are associated with spiritual death, which is insight. And yes, we needn't be scared of the term spiritual death, because spiritual death is the phoenix, sort of setting up the conditions to be made new, to be transformed. Spiritual death always leads to spiritual rebirth, to spiritual transformation. When I first explored the idea of Amitabha being about insight particularly, I found it a bit incongruous at first. I suppose I thought, well, the outstanding feature of Amitabha seems to be love and compassion, not insight. But love and compassion are an excellent road to insight. They're an excellent road to wisdom. Partly because, as Sankarakshita talks about, in order to develop insight, in order for that to be deepened and maintained, and in order almost to kind of go into that territory, it's really, really helpful to have what he calls a reservoir of positive emotion. The more metta you have, the more positive emotion you have, the easier it is to look at the nature of things. Could sort of unpack that at length, but I don't really have time right now. Love and compassion are also an excellent road to wisdom because they draw us out of ourselves. When we are in touch with metta, when we're in touch with compassion, karuna, we venture out, almost without quite noticing it, we venture out of the ego castle. We go out to other people. We go out to situations. Our heart opens. We go out to life. To care. To help. To do our best for someone else or some situation. And if we keep doing that day after day, over time, keep on venturing out because, yes, we care about that person. We want to help this situation. We love the world more and more. As we do that, eventually, venturing out of the ego castle day after day, one day we may forget to return to it. We may actually just live out there in the wide world beyond the ego castle. And love and compassion take us on that, in that direction. Love and compassion take us from I and me to we. They take us from me first to you first. And not just in that polite after you English way, but in a real deep way. So if we get that far, if we can really be living on retreat, you know, sort of, yes, thinking, well, I want to have my retreat, but also, you know, I want to be part of a retreat where I'm also helping set up the conditions for other people to go deeply into themselves, to transform themselves, to free themselves. If we're just opening our hearts more and more, there's only one more step, really, to a real deep insight. Let's imagine that you're doing metta bhavana, and on one particular day, somehow the force is with you, and it goes really well. And at the end of the fifth stage, there you are. You really are just pouring metta out to the world. You really sort of feel open to all life. You just long for it to be well. You just long for it to be happy. You just really care deeply. So that's tremendously sort of expanded. You're just like a great kind of wave of metta, pouring out like some kind of great red Amitabha lighthouse, just pouring light out in sort of bursts into the world. All that you have to do then is just let go. It's almost just kind of create a gap of awareness where you see the underlying assumptions that you're still, the story you're still telling yourself, which is me sending metta to the world out there. And it's possible at that point just to almost like do a sixth stage of the metta. We just let go of any idea of other beings. You let go of any sense of me sending out metta to those beings. And you can even let go of the idea of love and metta. And then, it's just like there's a field. It's just a loving field of awareness. And there are all beings in that. There's just like a big loving heart in which everything is contained. And there's no centre, there's no circumference. That's just it. So it's just that one step of just sort of taking apart the story we're telling ourselves around the practice. If we can really just go deeply into metta, we're almost there. So love and compassion are a fantastic entrance into insight practice. Metta is a tremendous practice. It may be that even just the sheer force of our metta, the force of our karuna, as I say, it may lead to us just forgetting all about ourselves completely anyway. It may just all happen quite naturally. So yes, I think Amitabha is good as a symbol for insight, for spiritual death. And a lot of his symbolism is very appropriate. The lotus goes through constant transformations, out of the mud, through the water, into the light. And as I say, the lotus has that softness, that softness that comes when there is no hard sense of self right in the middle of things, and there's no sense of other things being fixed, hard, graspable, clingable onto forever and ever. A lotus is a symbol of life, of unfoldment. So with insight we see everything as unfolding. We see the potential in everything. And then there's the setting sun. It's a bit as if when we move into the mandala, we move into the mandala with awareness. That's where the mandala door opens. As I said, if there's no awareness, there's no gap of awareness between stimulus and response, then there's no mandala. We're not in the mandala. We're just back in samsara. So to start with, we develop reflexive awareness. We know that we know. I know that I'm gesturing it at the moment sort of in a slightly circular way with my right hand as I'm explaining this point. Yeah. So there's reflexive awareness there. And we strengthen that. We strengthen that knowing of what's happening, that knowing of how we are, more and more. And that reflexive awareness dawns in the east, and it kind of reaches its zenith in the south, where we become a very positive sense of self, a very positive, aware me, really knowing what's going on, really responding creatively to life out of a sense of abundance and richness. But still, there's this very positive me. And that's still an idea, that's still a story, that's still separate. So even that needs to be transformed. So that sun of reflexive awareness sinks. And that's not a regression, that's a going on. To the everyday self, that looks a bit scary, just as presumably to primitive man. You know, the setting sun going down over the ocean, drowned in the ocean. But we know that it doesn't drown in the ocean. It's sort of, it goes on beyond what anything that we can see. So similarly, even that very positive sense of me eventually has to give way to something that is beyond subject and object, to a different way of experiencing altogether. And then there are other symbols. There's fire, which, as we've seen, fire is all about transformation. And yeah, there's the image of the phoenix rising out of the ashes. So out of spiritual death arises someone freer, wiser, more loving, more compassionate, more energetic. And then there's this dhyana mudra, which is the gesture of meditation. But it's an interesting gesture because it's encompassing a space. It's encompassing, actually there's nothing between the hands, and that space is really important. It's as if we're a fixed me, if we were really fixed, well, there could be no change, there could be no transformation. We would just be how we are, for better and worse. We would just be like this. But actually, because we're an open space of awareness, out of that open space, all kinds of qualities can appear, all kinds of qualities can be produced. Because we're not finally fixed as anything, we can completely transform. And that open space of awareness, out of which anything can appear, all good qualities can be produced, that's That's the Dhyana Mudra of Amitabha. So, I've talked about the approach to Shakyamuni and Mahārāja-svāmīs and that beautiful incident of the weapons transforming into flowers, and how you can see that on the level of dwelling in the gap between feeling and craving, on the level of love and compassion, and the level of insight, of spiritual death. And it's important that we have some element of insight practice in our general Dharma practice. This is something that Sankaracharya has been stressing in the last year or so. And in a way, all we have to do is keep moving along a spectrum. One end of the spectrum is wrong view, where we're just taking on the assumptions of the world around us, and the world around us isn't enlightened, so taking on its assumptions isn't likely to enlighten us. And then we move from there to forging right view, to really forging, not in the sense of counterfeiting, but forging in the sense of, you know, you forge something in a fire, like a blacksmith. You create something. So we need to find right view and make it our own. Yeah, if we get involved with the Dharma, we get presented with right view. We get told how things are. We get told, you know, how to approach life in a way that goes with the grain rather than against it, so that we don't suffer. But hearing that isn't enough. We have to really make it our own. We have to take it in deeply so that it becomes our natural way of seeing the world. And that involves a lot of work. It involves, yes, the effort to take in the Dharma, to listen to it, to read it, to hear it. But then we have to reflect on it. We have to really kind of see, you know, to what extent do we believe this? Why should we believe this? Is this really true in our experience? We'll have a bit of a session maybe this afternoon, in the afternoon meditation. We'll do a little bit of reflection and then a little bit of just sort of going, a little bit of insight meditation as well. But yes, this level of forging a right view for ourselves that we can rely on because we know it, because we've really sort of turned it over for ourselves. That's really important. And then we carry on up the spectrum to direct experience, to actually no view, to the point where we're not relying on ideas about life, we're not standing on them, we're just completely in life. We know the nature of life because we've seen it for ourselves. And that's particularly as we become more experienced with the Dharma, that needs to be an element in our practice. It's not that we stop reflecting. Even very experienced practitioners need to keep that element going. But yes, it's very important that as we go deeper with our practice, we're starting to question fundamental assumptions about life. That starts with looking to see whether things are impermanent or not. Was the Buddha right? In our experience, do we see things arising in dependence on conditions or not? Just going into all these things. And for order members, we have a range of practices, visualization practice, six element practice, deep just sitting, various ways of really taking apart our fundamental views and seeing how things really are. But also, even if as an order member you're just doing I don't mean that pejoratively, even if you're simply doing just mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, even if you're working mainly on the shamatha level, it's quite good if you just get a bit clear, just from time to time, just for a few seconds even, just to look at who it is that's meditating. Just look at the meditator. What is that made up of? What is that? See if you can get to know that. And also, not only what is it constituted of, but could you just let it go and go deeper into meditation as a result? So, I think that's enough to be going on with. I'll just leave you with a few questions. Firstly, we can dwell on Amitabha, and what is there about Amitabha, the image, the symbolism and connections that moves you or that speaks to you? Is there anything which intrigues you or which seems to bring your spiritual intuition alive? And if you find something, how could you bring more of that into your practice? How could you help it to grow? And then we can just look at those different levels or aspects of the Buddha with Mara's army and that aura, turning things into flowers. Firstly, there's the level of dwelling in the gap. In your life, for instance, where are you good at dwelling in the gap? And where do you tend to get carried away? Where do you just lose it? How could you set up conditions to support that awareness more? And then we could look at the love and compassion aspect, and particularly in terms of turning towards our experience, whatever it is, particularly aspects of it that we find difficult. Just discuss around that. Now, how do we work with those difficult emotions? Are we on the run from ourselves in some areas? How can we learn to turn towards difficult experience? How could we set up the conditions so that we felt we might even dare to give that a try? How could we do that? And then on the level of insight, is there an element in our practice of just questioning our views and assumptions about life? Are we reflecting on the Dharma to make it our own? Are we really taking it into ourselves, not just taking it on because the Buddha said so or the Sutra is saying so or whatever, but are we really taking it into our bones so it will help us in crucial situations and difficult times in our lives? And then particularly for maybe the order discussion groups, but also for others where it's appropriate, are we exploring the nature of the person, the nature of the self, that person who's doing all this Dharma practice and hoping to become enlightened? Are we actually examining that? But I'm sure just dwelling on Amitabha and his symbolism and that story of Mara bringing his armies against the Buddha, and the Buddha just sitting there deep in meditation with that aura of light around him, and all those flowers, all those weapons just turning to flowers so that it's raining flowers, raining wisdom. If you just contemplate that, I'm sure you have plenty of material to work with.